Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Silver by Linda Nagata, narrated by Nicole Poole. Chapter 1. Riffin Naja existed, at present, as an electronic entity, a ghost inhabiting the virtual library of the Outrider, Artemis. The library provided a simulation of physical existence, so that he perceived himself as sitting alone, comfortably situated in a cozy chair within a reading room, the surrounding walls lined with stacked files. A tablet floated in front of him at perfect reading height. It displayed the text of an ancient academic paper, Experimental Social Systems of the Expansion Period, a fascinating topic. Or it would have been, if not for his simmering anxiety and pessimism as he waited for the pilot to announce the next stage of the mission. At last, the moment came. The pilot's disembodied voice spoke directly into Riffin's sensorium.
Our initial alignment is complete. We are in position and ready to attempt contact with Pythias.
Oh, finally!
The tablet dodged out of the way as Riffin sprang to his feet. He was desperate to move forward, and yet he dreaded what he might find.
There are so few chances left, he murmured. Let this be the one.
The pilot, who had not been designed to engage at the level of human empathy, made no reply. Riffin had spent time enough in his company that he did not expect one. He turned to the reading room's door. Sensing his attention, the door shimmered and then vanished, leaving an open portal. Riffin stepped through it to the boundless blue gradient plane of the main library floor. His arrival attracted the invisible presence of a dull intelligence. It hovered on the periphery of his sensorium, ready to fetch files or execute searches at his command. But he had not come to conduct research. He turned instead to the waiting apparatchiks, each isolated within a frameless window. Riffin had brought three of them, the pilot, the biomechanic, and the engineer. He'd chosen them over a human companion, because as artificial entities they were more efficient in their use of Artemis's limited computational resources. The three together could operate in place of a single fully realized human ghost. Riffin didn't regret choosing the apparatchiks, not really. Still, he never felt easy in their presence, and they always appeared to be annoyed in his. The pilot reported,
"We are an estimated 912.3 kilometers from Pythias."
As always, he presented himself as a mysterious figure, no more than a black silhouette against a background three-dimensional star map.
"Which means," the biomechanic explained in a dull tone, "that at long last we are close enough to pinpoint Pythias's receiving lens."
His talents had not yet been required on the mission, and his appearance reflected that. He'd faded within his frame, becoming translucent, almost invisible as he floated in a sea of motile tissue, as if to suggest he might soon wither away from boredom. The engineer had also been superfluous so far, but he at least remained solid and attentive. Dressed in tan, he stood with his arms crossed, his brow creased in an impatient scowl. He said,
"Our angle of view shows no external damage, and Pythias's hull temperature is normal."
"Just as expected,"
Riffin said, knowing the damage would be on the inside. During the fiery war for possession of the fleet's primary starship, Dragon, contact had been lost with all the Outriders except Artemis. The war was successful in that the entity Lazuri was cast out, but Urban was lost too. Urban! He had been the soul of the starship, its commander, its very mind, until Lazuri's electronic predator wiped him out, erasing all the copies of his ghost that had existed aboard the courser. And then the predator had departed Dragon to destroy the archived ghosts Urban kept on every Outrider in the vanguard of the fleet. Riffin's mission was to determine whether or not the Predator had succeeded. He'd begged for the privilege of undertaking that task. He saw it as a step toward atonement, after he'd allowed his credentials to be appropriated by Lazuri. He still did not understand how that had happened, but it had happened, and Lazuri had used that access to introduce the Predator into Dragon's network. The pilot, sounding impatient, summoned him back to the present moment, reminding him,
"The next step is yours."
"Yes, of course."
Any of the apparatchiks could have handled the next phase, but Riffin had reserved communications for himself.
He opened a small window, arranging it at a low angle so that it mimicked a physical console. A swift tap against a green button initiated a procedure that had come to feel routine. The first step, a burst from the communications laser. With no discernible delay, the data gate on Pythias returned a responding code.
"Contact confirmed,"
Riffin said, unnecessarily, because the apparatchiks had access to the same data he did. But saying it out loud made him feel part of a team.
"Response code affirms the data gate is closed to inbound and outbound traffic. Sending safe mode override now."
He touched the next green button. Safe mode allowed limited data transfers. Nothing so complex as a ghost or a predator would be able to slip through.
"Safe mode confirmed,"
Riffin said, reading from his window.
"Initiating diagnostic function."
He had already visited the Outriders Alepio, Khonsu, and Lam La. Like Pythias, they had not deviated from their assigned course toward the Tangiri star system, despite the loss of communications. Each had been located at its calculated position. Finding them had been a simple matter of catching up. Simple, except that a gulf of roughly 90 light minutes separated each Outrider from the next, leaving Riffin 6.4 billion kilometers from his home aboard Dragon and from anything human, a distance further magnified because the fleet was no longer bound for Tangiri. Both Dragon and its companion courser, Griffin, had changed trajectories to pursue Lazuri to his home system of MSC G349809 and the ring-shaped world of Vera Lotus. Riffin closed his eyes. He refocused his thoughts, knowing he had to be careful. It would be so easy to fall into a debilitating hyper-awareness of his own utter isolation.
"Stay on task, you idiot."
He had run the diagnostic function on each of the first three Outriders. Their data gates were vested with a hard-coded routine used to analyze and inventory the associated computational strata. Every report had come back the same. Nothing found. No archives, no files, no structure, no activity, no readable data, not even fragments, no hint of Urban's ghost. The mind and memory of each Outrider had been wiped clean. Riffin wanted to stay hopeful, but so far nothing about Pythias suggested its condition would be any different. Once the diagnostic report confirmed it, he would send a tool to wipe the computational strata a second time, and a third time after that, ensuring that if anything nasty remained scattered in the chaos of the empty strata, it would be denatured and utterly erased. After that, he could safely open the data gate in standard mode, allowing essential systems to be copied over from Artemis. A dull intelligence would follow, and Pythias would once again be endowed with cognitive life. The DI would undertake a thorough physical inspection, ensuring the Outrider carried no functional alien matter. Only when that task was successfully completed would it adjust the Outrider's course, returning it to the fleet. Long before then, Riffin would be on his way, in pursuit of Fortuna, to repeat the process one last time. Such was the future he envisioned, but Pythias shattered his gloomy expectations. It awoke, responding to the activity at the data gate by sending a request to establish full communications. The message brought Riffin a brief shock of hope, until he saw it was signed with the credentials of one Riffin Naja.
"Corruption take us," he swore, "and chaos too."
From the apparatchiks, a chorus of grim chuckles.
"It's you,"
the biomechanic said in cynical amusement.
"Credentials out of date,"
the engineer noted.
"We found the predator,"
Riffin concluded. That should have been grim news, yet it brought him a resurgence of hope.
"The predator is here."
And since every data gate's default protocol was to leave no copy of a transiting ghost behind,
"that means it's not on Fortuna. Maybe it never reached Fortuna."
If so, they were sure to find a copy of Urban's ghost cached on the last Outrider. The engineer swiftly pointed out the flaw in this happy scenario.
"If Fortuna avoided the Predator and remained undamaged, it would have returned to the fleet when communication was lost. It did not, so something happened to it."
Hope collapsed, leaving Riffin teetering on the edge of a steep slide into despair. His chest expanded as if to draw in a deep, calming breath. But a ghost did not breathe, and the action produced no relief. His anxiety ratcheted up instead as a new thought intruded.
We're lucky we found Pythias at all. It's strange the Predator didn't hijack it and use it.
To do what? Attack the fleet? Riffin rejected the idea. Clementine would have destroyed Pythias if it approached without proper credentials. Follow Lazuri, then?
No, Lazuri surely would not care what happened to the Predator once its job was done.
It wasn't luck,
the biomechanic told him.
The Predator is very likely a limited tool designed for a singular task.
The task of erasing Urban from existence,
Riffin said bitterly.
Just so,
the pilot agreed.
Not a goal requiring general intelligence.
I suppose not. So the Predator has been trapped here. Is that the conclusion?
Trapped between here and Fortuna,
the engineer clarified. Riffin winced at this reminder that he must not place any hope in Fortuna.
All right, then. Let's move on to the next task. We have to get rid of the Predator.
The biomechanic had developed a plan to do that. He would introduce an array of makers to physically disassemble and then regrow all of Pythias's computational strata. Contemplating this, Riffin found himself speaking his deepest fear aloud.
What if there's a copy of Urban's ghost still archived aboard Pythias?
It will be erased,
the biomechanic answered.
Yes, exactly,
Riffin said.
It has already been erased,
the engineer assured him.
The Predator will have destroyed it.
I agree that's likely, but the Predator could not have wiped all the strata, or it would have wiped itself, so it is possible a hidden archive has survived.
The biomechanic shrugged.
If so, we cannot access it.
The engineer nodded his agreement.
To try would be to risk the Predator gaining access to this ship, and once here,
it'll wipe us out too,
Riffin concluded. And if he allowed that to happen, then Artemis, Pythias, and Fortuna would all be lost, and no report would ever get back to the fleet. Even so, Riffin felt reluctant to order the destruction of Pythias's computational strata. Once done, it could not be undone. And if Fortuna did not harbor a copy of Urban's ghost, then Urban would be gone forever, unrecoverable, dead, in the ancient sense of the word. And Riffin would wonder forever if he had ordered the last copy to be erased along with the Predator. But wiping Pythias was the only responsible decision, and in the end, he ordered it to be done. On to Fortuna. Artemis accelerated, taking Riffin farther still from Dragon. He tried not to think about that or to succumb to doubt. He tried to be hopeful as they closed in on the coordinates where the pilot calculated Fortuna must be. Riffin set about hunting for the gravitational signature of its reef, but he could not find it. He used radar to search, but turned up nothing, not even a debris cloud to indicate Fortuna had been destroyed in a collision. Eventually, he had to conclude,
"It's not here."
A sense of wonder filled him.
It must have gone somewhere else. Fortuna ignored its directive to return to the fleet, and it went somewhere else instead.
He turned to the pilot.
Would Fortuna's DI have the capacity to undertake such an independent action?
No.
The pilot answered.
Only a fully realized ghost could have directed the Outrider to follow a new course.
Riffin smiled in quiet triumph.
I thought so.
At last, he found evidence that Urban still existed. Chapter 2 Before Lazuri, Urban had known optimism. He'd been driven by a spirit of discovery. Confidence hard won from overcoming the threat of the alien Kenzeme had led him to believe he could tackle the hallowed vasties next and unravel the mysteries of what had happened there. Now, all such hope was gone to bitter dust. He'd been forced to flee Dragon in a running battle that left him isolated on Fortuna. And when he'd turned the Outrider's telescope to look back, he'd seen the fallout of war, Dragon degassing within a cloud of debris and Griffin gone altogether. While Dragon slowly self-repaired, the victor in that brief war remained unclear. But when the courser shifted its heading away from Tangieri and toward the nameless star MSCG-349-809, Urban had to conclude Lazuri was in control. No one else could have known the significance of that destination, a conclusion reinforced when Dragon disappeared from view, the light of its luminous hull cells quenched as it entered stealth mode. Had Lazuri allowed the ship's company to survive? The question haunted Urban. He wanted desperately to believe that when he recaptured Dragon, he would find them still aboard. He had no way yet to recover the ship, but he hoped for a solution among the bizarre artificial structures of Lazuri's home system. That system's star was similar to Earth's sun, but instead of inner planets, it had the blade. Lazuri claimed to have made it. A thin fracture in space-time, locked in a perfect circle, bleeding white light, and vast in size. 650,000 kilometers in diameter, the luminous ring moved in a stable orbit around its sun. At the geometric center of the blade, far smaller but still planetary in scale, was the ring-shaped artificial world of Verilotus. If Lazuri could be believed, time ran more swiftly there than in the wider universe. Urban intended to reach Verilotus and use every bonus minute that time differential allowed to prepare for Lazuri's arrival. The dull intelligence that handled the details of Fortuna's operation could not suffer boredom, distraction, or despair, so Urban relied on it to continuously survey the MSCG 349809 system throughout his years-long approach. He endured the time by switching off his consciousness for 12-hour intervals, staying awake only long enough to review any updates compiled by the DI and, rarely, to issue it new instructions. Astronomical records recorded two gas giant planets in the outer system. The DI calculated their positions and quickly located them, but it could not find the tiny moons that should have been orbiting those worlds. This concerned Urban. Lazuri had spoken of a partner entity as being as powerful, or more so, than him.
"If those moons still exist, I need to know where they are," he told the DI. "I need to locate every rogue planetoid and large asteroid in the system, anything resembling the rock where I found Lazuri."
If there really was another entity, it might be occupying a similar world.
"Understood," the DI responded, but it found nothing on a scale that Fortuna's single telescope could resolve. Hungry for better data, Urban cannibalized some of Fortuna's limited mass, using it to assemble a trio of probes. As he neared the system, he sent them ahead, one at a time, boosting them to velocities he did not dare approach himself. And he continued to watch. The blade never varied in size, but it did wax and wane in brightness. He guessed that it brightened when tiny amounts of matter contacted it and were converted to energy, or shed energy on the way to another reality. Lazuri had said the blade was a mechanism used to invert gravity and slice apart worlds. Urban took that as a warning, and resolved to stay as far from it as he could on his approach to Verilotus. The probes radioed their findings at regular intervals. Their signals could not be hidden, but that was not an absolute disadvantage. If there was a defensive architecture in the system, he hoped it would detect the probes, react to them, and reveal itself. 297 days after the first probe was launched, the DI woke his ghost early, informing him, "Alpha probe has failed to report as scheduled." Urban had long ago limited the emotional range of his ghost, and still he felt a stirring of trepidation.
"What about the others?"
"Beta and Gamma continue to report as normal."
"Watch them,"
he instructed, suspecting Alpha probe had crossed a perimeter and been hit by a laser or some other defensive weaponry. For the next 60 days, the telescope tracked the Beta probe as it approached, and then passed beyond Alpha's last known position. Both Beta and Gamma continued to function normally. Eventually, Urban concluded the first probe was probably a victim of accident rather than malice, damaged or destroyed in a random collision. The two surviving probes continued to converge on Verilotus, returning ever more detail on the ring-shaped world. For a body of its size, it rotated with astonishing speed, 10 rotations for every day measured on a standard clock. Its shape was a lean torus, circular in cross-section. Only the presence of an artificial gravity could explain how it kept its outer surface wrapped in atmosphere. That surface was startlingly Earth-like. The outward-facing half of the torus was mostly land, with diverse terrain, mountains, rolling hills, great rivers, grassy plains, stretches of desert, and to the north and south, long coastlines, ice-locked and arctic, where the land extended into polar regions. The ring's inner surface was ocean, a shallow light blue sea flecked with bright white floes of ice. A minor tilt in the ring's orientation allowed the inner wall to receive a measure of sunlight each day. Although days there were short, the ocean did not freeze over. As the probes drew still closer to Verilotus, they sighted a large city. It stood in foothills at the edge of a desert, extending for over 100 kilometers, the first visible indication of human habitation. But when additional images came in, Urban wondered if it was a city after all. The new images clearly showed glass towers closely packed across the rolling hills, some of dizzying height. But their arrangement was chaotic, many had fallen, and drifts of broken glass clogged the spaces between them. At night, the supposed city was dark. The probes also mapped thousands of small settlements, some with only one or two buildings, others with hundreds. But each settlement, regardless of size, was at least partly enclosed by a tall surrounding wall. Where the walls were incomplete, the probes detected no activity and observed no lights at night. Many of those with intact walls also appeared to be abandoned, but some were clearly occupied. Well-tended fields and orchards surrounded them, and lights came on each evening. There was another kind of light that could be seen at night, a strange silvery glow separate from any settlement. It appeared in branching streams, sometimes in smooth lakes. Urban observed it frequently in mountains, in a few hilly areas, and in the desert near the ruins of the great city. In other places, it appeared only rarely or not at all. Eventually, the probes distinguished vehicles moving on a simple network of roads linking the active settlements. The DI mapped these roads, it counted the settlements, and it reported its conclusions to Urban. "The present population of this world appears to be very low, on the order of 10,000 to 20,000, while the frequency of abandoned habitations indicates a higher population in the recent past, perhaps as high as 1 to 2 million. If the DI was right, these people had endured a disastrous plunge in population. What had happened to them, and when? The probes looked for activity above the surface of Verilotus, but found none. No elevator column or satellites or space stations. They did pick up radio transmissions, but the DI could not unscramble them. How much did these people understand of the workings of their world? Urban had seen historical dramas set in societies where people held nonsensical beliefs, even fighting wars to defend them. He pondered what his best approach might be, but that would depend on how much time he had. He contemplated the madly spinning world, 10 rotations in every 24 hours, and concluded this represented the ratio of time passing on Verilotus. It was not enough. 10 days to each one that passed on the outside did not give him time to insert himself into a strange society, learn its ways, and make use of its technological knowledge. Compounding the problem, his study of Verilotus left him with serious doubts about the extent of that technological knowledge. By this time, his observations had convinced him Verilotus was meant to be a beautiful world, a work of art, a tribute to the origin world of Earth that he knew only from history and dramas. But there was one feature on its surface that felt wrong, neither natural nor Earth-like. In the great desert, adjacent to the ruined city, his probes observed a huge, steep-sided crater, 80 kilometers across, its flat floor sunk more than 700 meters deep in the desert's ruddy brown plain. The crater was rimmed in black slag shot through with veins of colored minerals, purple and rose pink, pale green and electric blue. Why would Lazuri create such a feature? Urban suspected he had not. The crater looked too much like a wound, a scar of war. War had erupted between Lazuri and his partner, his lover. It had been a conflict so violent, Lazuri barely survived it.
"She cast me away, shattering my mind with the force of her gesture."
Lazuri had called her a goddess, but he did not know if she survived. Urban watched the strange silvery light of Verilotus illuminate that crater on many nights, far more often than anywhere else, and he couldn't help thinking something was there. Something with secrets to tell. Chapter 3. We stopped where the highway crested a rise, my brother Jolly and me,
some 70 miles from Sanctuary at the Temple of the Sisters. We had seen no other traffic on the road all day. The engines of our off-road bikes hummed softly, just audible over the soughing of a wind still warm with the afternoon's heat. That would change soon. In minutes, the sun would be gone behind the distant plateau known as the Kaling Crescent, taking the day's warmth with it. In the vast desert of the Araliad, nights were always cold. I switched off my bike's engine and lowered the kickstand. Jolly's little dog, Moki, jumped down from where he rode and had been between Jolly's knees. We all walked to stretch our legs. Beside me, my long, distorted shadow mocked my young woman's figure as it flexed over the roadside's tumbled stone. All around us lay the rough, reddish-brown mineral expanse of the Araliad, an austere land of low ridges and steep gullies, surrounded only by pockets of brush and the occasional small tree. The ribbon of the white road ran through it, beneath a vast, cloudless blue sky. Jolly and I had made excellent time on it all day. The last time I'd come this way, the road had not reached so far south. "I wonder how long the road will hold out," I mused aloud. I did not believe it would take us all the way to the Temple of the Sisters. Jolly came to stand beside me, his sunglasses pushed up into his thick black hair and a water bottle in his hand. He was a handsome youth, not yet as tall as me, though I expected that within a year he would be. He half closed his eyes.
"There will be silver tonight. I can feel it already gathering under the ground."
I did not doubt him, though his words did not stir fear in me as they once would have. "If the road holds out, we'll get there well before the silver rises," I said. He gave me a sideways look and a teasing smile.
"And if not, we'll push on anyway. I know you're in a hurry, Jubilee."
Indeed. It had been 4 long years since we'd said goodbye to my friend Emil and returned home from the Temple of the Sisters, and though I was still but 21, Emil had been a very old man even then. Over the years, I'd had a few messages from him, but none for some time, and I only hoped I would still find him there. We put on jackets against the coming cold and set off again, doing a fast 40 miles through the gathering twilight before the road ran out. At its end, we came across a black, vibrant, glittering carpet of road-building kobolds, thumb-sized, beetle-like mechanics working together to convert desert sand and stone into concrete, extending the highway south. We rode around them, taking care not to crush any. We did not want to disturb their work. After that, we made our own way, riding on the backs of low ridges when we could. If the land had not changed, we would eventually reach a wide basin, flat and smooth as any road. I had hoped to come to it before the silver rose and then to run fast the rest of the way to the sisters, but night came too quickly. There is a special kind of silver existing in all players. We call it Ha. In most players, the Ha is dormant. They don't even know it exists. I didn't know until 4 years ago when my Ha first awakened, but Jolly discovered it when he was still a child. When the Ha becomes active, it is visible, appearing as tiny sparks dancing across the hands, whether in sunlight or in darkness. That evening, as twilight deepened, our Ha sparkled ever more brightly, as if to compete with the light of gathering stars. The thin, glittering arc of the bow of heaven was also emerging. Already bright in the east, it grew fainter as it reached the apex of the sky, and to the west its gleam was still lost amid twilight's lingering glow. But full dark was not far off. Through my Ha, I sensed the silver's imminent presence. I told myself I was not afraid. Still, my heart beat faster. I could feel the silver rising, feel it leaning against my awareness as if awaiting a command from me that I did not know how to give. I signaled the Jolly to stop again. "We can wait here," I said when he pulled up beside me. He nodded.
"It's a good place."
We had reached the end of a low ridge, with dry washes to either side that were tributaries to a broader dry wash just ahead. All was still. No birds flew, and no breeze stirred the crisp night air. Moki chose to stay in his bin instead of climbing out as he usually did when we stopped. He looked around with pricked ears, anxious, his soft whine the only sound until Jolly comforted him with whispered words and a gentle touch. We watched the low ground. After a minute, it began. A faint, silvery gleam in the sandy floor of the washes, barely discernible, brightening a moment later.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?